Lecture 60, Ernest Hemingway, Wordsmith.
This is Lecture 60, and it's the third Hemingway lecture, and it's the last lecture I want to give on The Sun Also Rises. I want to talk a lot about language in this lecture. I hope that's not going to seem dry to you. I don't think it's dry at all. You remember at the end of the last lecture, I remarked that one of the titles that Hemingway was considering for this book was Fiesta. And when they get to Pamplona, one of the sentences, I think it's the first sentence of the chapter, says, "The fiesta began with an explosion." And I used the word explosion in my own lecture. There's something explosive about this book, about its language, about what's being packed into its language. And this affords me an opportunity to talk about the Hemingway style in general. And Hemingway has some very famous pronouncements about language. In particular, in A Movable Feast, he writes about the solutions that he had to develop whenever he experienced writer's block, which, of course, is what all writers periodically experience. And he said this, "I would stand and look out over the roofs of Paris and think, do not worry. You have always written before, and you will write now. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. It was easy then because there was always one true sentence that I knew or had seen or had heard somebody say. That is really one of the articles of belief in Hemingway's philosophy, one true sentence. And, of course, this is that pared-down style that doesn't want to fake, doesn't want to be phony. It's like Romero's kind of bullfighting, purity of line, absolutely nothing bogus. As an aside, the concept of one true sentence can lead you to suicide, and I think it's part of the reason that Hemingway did commit suicide, because it begs the question, is there such a thing as a true sentence? A sentence is an arrangement of words, and the most pared-down sentence, the purest sentence with the most purity of line, is still a sentence. It's still a linguistic construct, and that language can't get beyond being language. And I think that Hemingway, as he continued to grow older, found it harder and harder to summon that one true sentence. Other writers like Joyce, for example, move from simple sentences to more and more complex and parodic kinds of experiments because they know that language only can lead to more language. That's the evolution. I think Shakespeare does something of the same. Well, Hemingway in A Movable Feast does write these kinds of sentences that he's talking about. I'll read you a sample of it. This is the kind of sumptuous Hemingway prose that for me is just immortal. Listen to how many of these words are monosyllabic. "When we came back to Paris, it was clear and cold and lovely. The city had accommodated itself to winter. There was good wood for sale at the wood and coal place across the street, and there were braziers outside of many of the good cafes so that you could keep warm on the terraces. Our own apartment was warm and cheerful. We burned boulets, which were molded egg-shaped lumps of coal dust, on the wood fire, and on the streets the winter light was beautiful. Now you were accustomed to see the bare trees against the sky, and you walked on the fresh, washed gravel paths through the Luxembourg Gardens in the clear, sharp wind. The trees were sculpture without their leaves when you were reconciled to them, and the winter winds blew across the surfaces of the ponds, and the fountains blew in the bright light." This is a nostalgic remembrance of Paris. It's a man in his 50s thinking about his own 20s and the romantic city where he spent that time. But that's the kind of language that Hemingway yearns for. It's the same kind of simple, clean language that he uses in the description of Jake preparing the trout after he's caught them, putting them on the fern leaves three at a time, then putting more fern leaves, and then having a bulky group of them that he could then put in the shade. There is in Hemingway a very principled, philosophical distrust of fancy words, of fancy language. It's a famous phrase or set of phrases from A Farewell to Arms, where the protagonist, Frederick Henry, says the following: I was always embarrassed by the words sacred, glorious, and sacrifice, and the expression in vain. We had heard them, sometimes standing in the rain, almost out of earshot, so that only the shouted words came through, and had read them on proclamations that were slapped up by bill posters over other proclamations, now for a long time, and I had seen nothing sacred, and the things that were glorious had no glory, and the sacrifices were like the stockyards at Chicago if nothing was done with the meat except to bury it. There were many words that you could not stand to hear, and finally only the names of places had dignity. Certain numbers were the same way, and certain dates, and these, with the names of places, were all you could say and have them mean anything. So that's the kind of paring down. That's why it's happening. It's not just a kind of predisposition for clean language. It's ultimately a kind of linguistic bankruptcy, rhetorical bankruptcy, that all of the $50 words, all of the highfalutin terms, particularly insofar as they throw us into a world that is bloated and inflated, that talks about honor and glory and the like, when you have actually seen the carnage of war, these words are obscene. You can't use them. They don't correspond to anything. They utterly blind you to the truth of the situation. Now, there's a lot going on. Hemingway then settles for the clean, simple words, but he wants his books to be resonant, to be dimensional, and that's the term he uses. I'm going to quote a passage, a famous description that comes out of the Green Hills of Africa. How far prose can be carried if one is serious enough and has luck? That's what he's looking for. There is a fourth and fifth dimension that can be gotten. A fourth and fifth dimension that can be gotten. Well, how do you get it? His interlocutor says, but that's poetry you're talking about. He says, no, it is much more difficult than poetry. It is a prose that has never been written, but it can be written without tricks and without cheating, with nothing that will go bad afterwards. It's that same notion that the inflated, bloated language will rot, will go bad. This is like the bogus bullfighters, the ones who pretend, and they look melodramatic. They pretend they're in danger, and that's what doesn't last. It won't stay. But with Romero, his purity of line is such that it stays with you forever. You can see, and I said then, this is also a kind of aesthetic philosophy. This is a way of viewing language and literature. But I want you to think about those terms, fourth and fifth dimensions, because I love that language. I think that what he's trying to say is that the right kind of writing has magic in it because it somehow continues to speak, continues to signify, and to resonate beyond the surface meaning. Those are the extra dimensions. That's what I've been trying to get at in this book, The Sun Also Rises, that it's packed, taut, condensed, and at the same time, it's echoing and resonant, and that it is achieving that kind of dimensionality. Part of this also is related to a kind of art of repression, of not saying too much. One conversation, Brett, at the end of the book, is talking to Jake, and she's trying to tell him about how good she feels now that she has forsworn Romero, and he says, you'll lose it if you talk about it. And again, I think that's a writerly notion, that too much said ruins everything. The way what you want is a book that is sort of reader-intensive, not writer-intensive, that makes the reader come in and fulfill your task or complete what you have started. So you want to convey a sense of doubleness, of ambiguity or ambivalence, mystery, something beyond the words. That's partly also the feeling that people had when they read this book. When Edmund Wilson read this novel, he thought there was a very peculiar consciousness in it. He said this particular consciousness, he said, does not arouse Hemingway to passionate violence, but it poisons him, it makes him sick, and thus invests with a singular quality, a quality perhaps new in fiction, the sunlight and the green summer landscapes of The Sun Also Rises. And that I alluded to that when I was talking about the presence, the looming, haunting presence of the war that is in this book, that's behind those idyllic fishing scenes, those notations that seem to be unspoiled. So I think that all of this is still part of an aesthetic, of a style of writing that aims precisely for you to feel this activity behind the surface. I told you as well that sometimes this is really quite literal. Hemingway would literally write passages out of his manuscript. He would probably do it with scissors. Say, if I remove this, the reader will feel it as a loss, will feel that something is stirring here, and that's the effect that I want to produce, that there's more to it, that what's unsaid is still present in some sense. And, of course, this is a secret to those wonderful dialogues that he writes. So this leads me to the remark that that this book is a kind of echo chamber, and in lots of different ways. It's a literary echo chamber. This book is literary to its fingernails and toenails, and that's not something Hemingway is ordinarily credited with. But this book is studded with allusions. It's not quite as blatantly allusive as The Wasteland is, which throws in six foreign languages. Nonetheless, it's a book that presents a lot of references to other kinds of writers. For example, Henry James takes two curtain calls in this book, and you may or may not have sensed it. It's very similar to Eliot's technique, that there is a famous passage, I read it to you when I was lecturing on James, in The Ambassadors. It's the passage, the great passage, where Strether urges little Bilhem to have his experience, that it's the great sort of summons to experience, and that if you have missed that, you've missed everything. Live all you can, James's character Strether says. Live all you can. It's a mistake not to. It doesn't so much matter what you do in particular, as long as you have had your life. Pardon me, as long as you have your life. If you haven't had that, what have you had? That comes back in this novel in a way that I think most readers who know a lot of James pick up in the early conversation between Jake and Robert Cohn, where Cohn says, Jake, don't you ever get the feeling that all your life is going by and you're not taking advantage of it? Do you realize you've lived nearly half the time you have to live already? Now, if that were the only thing in the text about James, you say, well, that's a pretty loose reworking of James. But James figures in still another way, and he's mocked in the text, and then you have to sort of know what the references are. This is that really sort of funny chit-chat between Bill and Jake when they're fishing in Spain, and they're doing a lot of sort of fun talk and parody talk. And Bill at one point says, that's the sort of thing that can't be spoken of. That's what you ought to work up into a mystery, like Henry's bicycle. Now, again, I'm pulling things out that most first-time readers would never see. Henry's bicycle relates to Henry James, and it relates, in fact, to an accident that Henry James had with a bicycle. And that relates to another accident that James had, which is the mysterious accident that many claim accounts for James' celibacy, that he received a kind of mysterious back injury at a certain point in his life. Hemingway has James on his mind here. James's character, Strether, urges little Bilhem to live all you can, but Strether himself renounces love in that book. He's the one who renounces both Madame de Vionnet and Maria Gostrey in a way of saying, I can have nothing for myself at the end of this. Hemingway read The Ambassadors as a book about sexual renunciation. And you know what he said? He said, James doesn't know anything about the subject. I'm the guy who can write that story. I'm going to write that story. That's what The Sun Also Rises is going to be. Now, you might think that's a harsh thing to say, but I'm going to quote you something that Hemingway himself wrote precisely to Charles Scribner in 1949, so this is a long time after he'd finished the book. For your information, I started out trying to beat dead writers that I knew how good they were. Excuse the vernacular. I tried for Mr. Turgenev, and it wasn't too hard. Tried for Mr. Maupassant, won't concede the de Maupassant, won't give him that. And it took four of the best stories to beat him. Mr. Henry James. I would just thumb him once the first time he grabbed, and then hit him once where he had no balls, and ask the referee to stop it. Okay? So James had made sexual renunciation look really a kind of grand position in the ambassadors, a kind of spiritual triumph. Strether will keep nothing for himself. That's the only way Strether knows how to complete this, to remain clean. Not going to be the case here. Jake is going to suffer and agonize, and so will Brett, because Jake can't give her what she needs. So I've mentioned at the beginning of my lectures that Hemingway slugs it out with everybody he knows, and a lot of people come in for a beating in this book as well. For example, H.L. Mencken, who again was a kind of major literary sort of avuncular figure by the time this book is written, he's nailed a couple of times. When, and this is the economy of Hemingway, he wants to nail Robert Cohn. And this is Jake bragging about how well he knows Paris. So Jake's talking about all the streets and which ones he likes and which ones you only walk down and other ones you ride down, because different experience depending on how you do it. And then he thinks, but maybe I'd only read about this street. Then he says that was the way Robert Cohn was about all of Paris. I wonder where Cohn got that incapacity to enjoy Paris. Possibly from Mencken. Mencken hates Paris, I believe. So many young men get their likes and dislikes from Mencken. Get Cohn, get Mencken, and get Jake all at the same time in a few sentences there. Well, Mencken has a repeat performance, which you may not have picked up. It's in that same bantering conversation between Bill and Jake. And they're talking about utilize this. They're utilizing a lot of wine at that time and drinking, turning the bottle upside down and everything into their mouths. And at one point, Bill says, "What shall we say, brother?" And they've got the chicken that they've taken on their for their picnic lunch, the drumstick. He pointed the drumstick at me and went on, and he has this long spiel. And at the end he says, "Let us kneel and say, don't eat that, lady," this drumstick. "That's Mencken." Now, this is a lewd reference. It's called by the critics Mencken's member. I mean, they're holding this drumstick there. "Don't eat that, lady. That's Mencken." All right, so you know, this is gratuitous, and it's amazing that he was able to get this through, that people didn't knock this stuff out of the book. As I said, James wrote a story of sexual renunciation. Hemingway's telling a story of sexual renunciation, too, and Hemingway wants you to think that Brett is heaving and panting because she's been denied Jake. And as I suggested in looking carefully at some of that material, it's not clear that Jake and she are not, in fact, having something together. But I remind you of the Fitzgerald comment that I quoted, that Fitzgerald wrote him and said, you know, something doesn't make sense in this book. I don't think he's impotent. He doesn't come across like a man who's impotent. He comes across like a man who has a moral straitjacket. And I want to suggest that there is an incapacity there that's not just sort of an accident of war. It's not just a physical inability or disability. That there is a kind of sort of, it's a kind of working, valid condition that Jake, unwilling, unable to penetrate women, as I said, is aligned to the figure of Romero, who dances and teases the bull and gets as close as possible without being gored. And I want to suggest that a man who cannot have sex with women has its own resonance in this text. Now, this text, I'm going to talk about other forms of sexuality. The text does not talk much about homosexuality. It has one or two references to gays, and they're very distasteful references. You see men coming into the bar when Jake and friends are there, and they make some references to them. But I want you to think about the Paris environment that Hemingway is part of. And this is a little tendentious, what I'm going to say, but I think it certainly helps prepare us for the next book we're going to talk about, which is that Paris in the 20s is a place of enormous sexual experimentation. and gender bending. This is Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. This is Sylvia Beach, who was a lesbian. This is Jenny Pfeiffer, who was Pauline Pfeiffer's sister. Pauline Pfeiffer is Hemingway's second wife. It's the woman that, in fact, he is moving to in the 20s as he's leaving Hadley for Pauline. Pauline's sister, Jenny, is a practicing lesbian, and it turns out later that Pauline herself, after her marriage with Hemingway, will come to prefer women as partners. Janet Flanner, another well-known literary figure, lesbian in Paris then. Hemingway had encountered lesbians before that. There is some scholarship that says that his mother, Grace, had had female friends where there was a sexual dimension to their relationship. And then two of the most famous lesbians in Paris at the time that Hemingway is writing this book, here are the names here, are Natalie Barney and Juna Barnes, and they are living at the Rue Jacob. And this man's name is Jacob Barnes. So that people have said, you know, his dysfunctionality as a kind of male stud figure, the book is divided into bulls and steers, talks about that. There's a bull-steer philosophy. It has to do with you were the penetrator or you were the penetratee, one or the other. And Jake can't be put easily in either of these camps, because what Hemingway wants to do, I think, is to preserve the kind of ambivalence here, that Jake is sort of in all of these positions. I'm going to give you another really tendentious anecdote, which is the notion that some critics have, and that Zelda Fitzgerald had, that Hemingway and Fitzgerald were lovers. Now, we have read in The Movable Feast the way Hemingway puts down Fitzgerald. What he does is, it's called A Matter of Measurements, and it's hysterically funny, but it's really malicious, where Fitzgerald has great sexual anxiety and wants Hemingway to check him out because he says that Zelda has told him that he's not equipped to make her happy. And so Hemingway, the superior man, obviously, the expert, the savvy, the knowing man, checks him out and gives him all of this advice, talks to him about angles, about pillows, about all kinds of things, and says your wife is simply trying to geld you, more or less what he says. Well, that's what Hemingway wrote after Fitzgerald was dead. He was dead in 1940. In 1929, when there was a particular dinner party that Scott and Zelda had for Hemingway and Pauline, I'm quoting from one of the critics now, after they had been drinking at considerable length, the Fitzgeralds returned home, and as Scott was getting into bed, he drunkenly murmured, "No more, baby." Zelda took, I'm quoting Kenneth Lynn, the critic, took his words to mean that he was having a conversation in his mind with Hemingway, which may have been true. And from this conclusion, she leapt to the conviction that the two men were lovers. Zelda is famous for having thought that Hemingway's macho image was bogus. She called, that's the word she used. She told Scott, he is bogus. She described his, you know, I told you he's a colossus of a man. She described his muscular exhibitionism as, quote, phony as a rubber check. And this is how she wrote about this event, that she would list this suspicion that Scott and Ernest were lovers as one of the reasons of her own mental breakdown. She said, "We came back to the Rue Palatine." She wrote this to her husband. "And you in a drunken stupor told me lots of things that I only half understood. But I did understand the dinner we had at Ernest's." And Fitzgerald denied it totally and wrote her saying that the nearest I ever came to leaving you was when you told me you thought I was a fairy in the Rue Palatine. So a lot of this is innuendo, it's hearsay, but it's not entirely fabricated out of nothing. All of it, I think, bears on the representation of Jake and the way this book is written. I said this is about language. There's an enormous amount of sexual innuendo in the novel. Brett, for example, when she sees the seductive, really inflammatory Pedro Romero as he's doing his act with the bull, she's inflamed. And she keeps asking, how does he get into those pants? You've seen, you know what bullfighters' pants look like. They're very tight. How does he get into his pants? And the answer comes over twice or three times. Pipe down, they say. How does he get into his pants? Pipe down. Pipe down. All right, you get it? You must get it. Okay. That's part, the book is going to put this kind of material in there. Her short hair, which Romero wants her to cut, clearly is what makes her the Circe figure, the erotic figure who turns the men around her into swine. And we're going to see how far that one goes later when we get to the Garden of Eden. That the fiesta, which is an explosion, that we have a very fascinating description of the fireworks at the carnival, that these fireworks that fell into the crowd and charged and chased, sputtering and cracking between the legs of people. And it's a nice notation. That's where the fireworks are happening in this book, is between the legs of people. One of the notations that comes off there is globos illuminados. And it comes up four times, a collection of globos illuminados, which is referring to fireworks, and I would call that lit up balls. Globos illuminados, Mike said, a bunch of bloody globos illuminados. I mean, they really thrust it at you. You can't miss this kind of language. And the joke lingo, are you joking him? Does he joke you? No, I don't joke him. And I suggested that that too has its own allusion to something else. Or the way words are used in a kind of playful manner that takes them out of their ordinary meaning. Festa. We're going to festa the English. I'll festa them, Bill said. We're going to festa the bloody English. They're talking about carnival, festa, but fiesta. But it begins to become a verb of particular sorts here. And the book, in key moments, will speak other languages. It will speak French. It will speak Spanish. But in English, I mean, there's some astounding phrases that when Jake goes to Madrid to rescue Brett, he goes to this hotel, and Hemingway replicates the way the lady who runs the hotel speaks to him. He's worried about leaving his luggage downstairs, and she says, the personages of this establishment were rigidly selectioned. And again, it has, I think, suggests his castration and emasculation as well. I was happy to hear of it. Nevertheless, I would welcome the upbringal of my bags. I mean, no one writes like that. And there are passages where French is done the same way, not to mention all the French and Spanish that is actually in the text with the names of streets and places and festivals and things like that. This book is multilingual. I'm talking to you about Hemingway's style, Hemingway's language. It's a carnival of its own. One of the great lines in the book is when Cohn sends him a telegram and it says, Vengo jueves con. I'm coming on Thursday. Cone. Telegram. And Mike reads it, or Bill, one of them, and says, what does cone mean? And he understands vengo jueves, which is I'm coming on Thursday. But the book wants to write in languages. It wants to take its material and turn it into puns. Is he joking you? Are you joking him? Turn it into puns. Could you festa them? Turn it into globos illuminados. All of that, I think, is a kind of verbal equivalent of the doubleness, the twinships, the double sexuality that plays out in this book. I referred to Edmund Wilson's comment that he felt that Hemingway's consciousness has something disturbed and sick and decaying behind the brilliant summer light and the fishing scenes and the idyllic passages. And I think that all of that is related to the argument that I'm making now, to somehow convey things, and they are what they are, and then also to suggest, but they're not that at all. Something else is behind them. You're supposed to sense that. That is the other country. It's a phrase Hemingway uses, another country. It's a world of the text which can have multiple spaces in it, dimensions, fourth and fifth dimensions of prose that you could achieve if you knew how to write it. One of the most beautiful passages in the book is when Jake, you recall that Cohn has called him a pimp. Jake reacts, and Cohn knocks him out because Cohn is the great boxer of the text. Cohn knocks him out, and Jake sort of is stunned and dazed. And Jake has this remarkable memory. He says, walking across the square to the hotel, everything looked new and changed. And it looks new and changed because of the trauma Jake has received, a trauma that simply alters perception. This passage is doubled by a memory of Jake returning to his hometown after a football game, walking the streets he'd walked all his life and not recognizing them. It was all strange, the text says. Only later do we learn that he had been kicked in the head early in the game. That's Hemingway's life story. To have been kicked in the head early in the game. To have been grievously wounded, whether on the Italian front and then coming back home to Oak Park on crutches, or as Nick Adams comes home wounded in Big Two-Hearted River, or as Harold Krebs comes home wounded psychically in Soldier's Home, or as Jake Barnes is sexually wounded in our novel Here. But that wound catalyzes a new vision of the world, a world that is strange, a world where nothing stays itself. This is going to be the world of the Garden of Eden. Thank you.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. I hope you've enjoyed these extraordinary lectures from our Great Courses on Tape series. For a detailed description of all of our courses, visit our website at www.teachco.com. And to order your next course, call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you.